Surprisingly, there is no benefit. Adding extra protein to the diets of Ultimate Minimum, the single greatest life extension you can do in a laboratory animal setting, is methionine restriction, which is found concentrated in animal proteins. Legumes are the centerpiece protein for every single Blue Zone ever documented. What happens to your cancer rate? Dramatic drop. What happens to your lifespan? Dramatic increase. What happens to cardiovascular disease risk? Goes down. Why? Because excess body fat is so devastating to one's health, shaving, 6 to 7 years off your lifespan.
Welcome to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast, where we meet the world's top experts to explore the secrets of health, mindset, longevity, and so much more. Are you ready to take charge of your existence and biohack your life? This show is for you. Please keep in mind, we're not dispensing medical advice and are not responsible for any outcomes you may experience from implementing the tactics lying herein. Are you ready? Let's do this. Welcome back to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast. Oh my goodness, friends, today's episode was a long, long, long time coming. I have been following the work of Dr. Greger for years and years, and he actually came on for an interview for this a few months ago, and I talk about this in the show, but I lost that episode, so he was so kind to come back and re-record. I am just honestly in awe with his kindness for doing that. I knew I had to share this content with you guys. I know my audience is often paleo, or keto, or even carnivore. So it's nice to have people on the vegan side of things share their perspective when it comes to health and wellness. I know there are a lot of different opinions out there, and we dive deep into things in today's episode. We talk about different perspectives on cholesterol and low LDL, the potential problems with a high protein diet, what happens with fertility and longevity on plant-based diets, the benefits of soy, the nuances of nitrates and nitrites, whether or not you should take spermidine, is slow metabolism actually good for longevity, the benefits of fiber, Dr. Greger's top 8 anti-aging foods, and so much more. The show notes for today's episode will be at melanieavalon.com/Greger. That's G-R-E-G-E-R. Those show notes will have a full transcript as well as links to everything that we talked about. So definitely check that out. And definitely check out Dr. Greger's newest book, How Not to Age. It is a deep, deep dive into longevity. There will be 2 episode giveaways for this episode. One will be in my Facebook group, IF Biohackers, Intermittent Fasting plus Real Foods plus Life. Comment something you learned or something that resonated with you on the pinned post to enter to win something that I love. And then check out my Instagram, find the Friday announcement post. And again, comment there to enter to win something that I love. Hey, friends. Did you know that one of our largest sources of toxic exposure each and every day is through our skincare and makeup? It is so frightening the effects these compounds can have on our health. So we put these products on to help us look better, and yet they actually can be aging us, contributing to health issues, fertility issues, thyroid issues, mood issues, and ready for something potentially even more shocking? A lot of these endocrine disruptors are actually obesogens, meaning they cause your body to gain weight and make it harder to lose weight. That's right, your skincare and makeup may be hindering your weight loss goals. Europe has banned thousands of these compounds, and the US has banned around a dozen. There's even a loophole from the 1960s that allows companies to put whatever they want in their products, and they don't even have to tell you. That's why I am overwhelmingly careful about the skincare and makeup that I use. But here's the thing, it can be hard to find skincare and makeup that is non-toxic and actually works. And then on top of that, that actually has all the products you need. I have found 2 companies, I am obsessed with their standards and use them every single day of my life and cannot recommend them enough. That's Counter, formerly known as Beauty Counter, and Crunchy. Both of these companies have incredible standards when it comes to what they put in their products. You can truly feel good about using them, and they actually work. For Counter products, go to melanieavalon.com/counter. And for Crunchy products, go to crunchy.com. That's crunchy.com/Melanie Avalon. New Crunchy customers can use the coupon code ADVOCATE10 to get 10% off. You'll also receive something special from me after your first order. I also highly recommend joining both of their loyalty programs. It's completely free to join, and with every purchase, you'll earn credit, as well as other fun goodies. For all the latest updates, new products, specials, deals, and fun things for me, because yes, I love giving things away, get on my email list. That's at melanieavalon.com/cleanbeauty. You can also get text updates when you text skincare to 877-861-8318. That's skincare to 877-861-8318. So again, to shop with me and get a free gift from me after your first order, go to melanieavalon.com/counter and also crunchy.com/melanieavalon. And new customers, use the coupon code ADVOCATE10 at Crunchy to get 10% off site-wide. And again, definitely join their free loyalty programs to earn credit on every order. Hi friends, exciting news. My Avalon X Spirulina is back in stock and now at a reduced price. Plus you get free shipping and my coupon code works on top of that sale price. Spirulina is honestly one of the most nutrient-dense things that you can put in your body in a whole foods, easy-to-eat form. It's a blue-green algae, which is a complete vegan protein packed with an incredible array of nutrients. We are talking 100% of your daily hard-to-get vitamin K, 625% of vitamin B12, over 1,000% of vitamin A, 86% of chromium, 27% of vitamin B2, plus so much more, including iron, GLA, the powerful antioxidant superoxide dismutase, and even glutathione. In fact, spirulina is so uniquely nutritious that it was actually studied by NASA to support the astronauts. I searched high and low to find the very best spirulina out there. Ours comes from a wonderful, sustainable, clean, environmentally friendly production facility in Hawaii. Not Thailand, Hawaii. And then on top of that, we did our own third-party testing for over 70 pesticides, heavy metals, toxins, all the things. This is the cleanest spirulina out there. And with spirulina, you can simplify your supplement routine and support your nutrition in one easy step. The tablets are super versatile. You can swallow them whole, blend them into smoothies, crush them up, or honestly, just eat them like I do. And again, we were out of stock, but now Avalon X Spirulina is finally back in stock at a reduced price, and my coupon code MelanieAvalon works on top of that too. Plus, you get free shipping. Just go to avalonx.us/spirulina and use the coupon code MelanieAvalon to get 10% off our new reduced price plus free shipping. That's avalonx.us/spirulina with the coupon code MelanieAvalon. All right, I think that's all the things. Without further ado, please enjoy this fabulous conversation with Dr. Michael Greger. Hi, friends. Welcome back to the show. I don't know if I've ever started a show with so much gratitude and smiles on my face as I have right now. The backstory on today's show, I am here with Dr. Michael Greger, who is a legend, friends, in the health and wellness sphere. I have been following his work for years. I told him this last time, and I will explain about the last time, but probably about a decade ago, honestly, I was doing a nutrition certification program, and the requirement for the program was actually to watch DVDs made from nutritionfacts.org to learn all about the benefits of a plant-based diet in particular. They were super deep on the science of things and looking at studies, and that was my first exposure to Michael Greger's work. Since then, he has released so many incredible books, including many New York Times bestsellers, and I have read most of them. I read How Not to Die. I read How Not to Diet. He also has the How Not to Die cookbook, and we are here today for his book, How Not to Age, which honestly, friends, I talk about aging a lot on this show. This is the deepest dive I have read. It is massive. You could use it as like a weight for like muscle building. It dives so deep into what actually causes aging, and then really, really deep into the role of diet in aging, and just literally it goes through pretty much every ailment associated with aging and how different dietary approaches affect it. It's just incredible. And the other reason I'm smiling so much is I actually already had this interview with Dr. Greger a few months ago, and I don't even know what happened. For the first time in like, how many episodes have I done of podcasting? Almost 600. 600, 700 episodes, I did not hit record. So I lost it. And he is so kind to come back and do a take two. So Dr. Greger, thank you so much for all that you do. I am so excited to interview you again. And yeah, thank you for being here.
I love the first one so much. We couldn't lose it. Let's do it again. Hopefully. It's a high bar though. I mean, I don't know.
I know. It's kind of nice that it's been a few months because I feel like I've kind of let it evanesce from memory. And so I can just kind of start afresh. But if I repeat myself, I apologize, but nobody will know except for us. So to start things off, a big question about, well, actually, I think this is how I started it last time. And I will start it again this way because I think it's really important. So the title is How Not to Age. And when I first saw that, and when I first saw How Not to Die and How Not to Diet, the thought is like it's about not aging or not dying. But is that what you mean by that title?
Well, just my earlier book, How Not to Die, was not about living forever. Right? It was not how to not die, but rather how not to die, as in prematurely in pain after long chronic disabling illness, right? And How Not to Age has a similar premise, right? The book's not about immortality, but rather how to age with grace and vitality rather than, you know, suffering from the ravages of infirmity and disease.
Exactly. So a little bit of a different transition there, or a different perspective. And so this concept of aging, there are so many different theories and interpretations. You know, I've had people on the show like David Sinclair who will say aging is disease. I've had people on the show who talk about reversing aging or, you know, reaching this point where we will reach immortality. I'm curious for you, do you think aging, is it a disease? Is it natural? Do our bodies naturally want to not age, or is it just part of the natural process?
Oh, well, I actually start out early in the book talking about the debate on whether aging itself is a disease, kind of one of the most contested questions in gerontology. You know, aging is, you say, well, that can't be a disease. It's natural, right? But yeah, but so is like getting an infection, right? We call that a disease. You say, well, yeah, but you can't call it a disease because aging is universal. But yeah, but everyone gets like the common cold too. It's interesting, if you ask people whether they think a variety of conditions classified as disease, you get this odd mix. Like, you know, alcohol dependence is considered a disease, but nicotine dependence, smoking, not considered a disease, right? It's interesting. The general public is actually more likely to view aging as a disease than physicians, even though, God, you know, physicians love medicalizing everything. But medicine's kind of hesitant to label aging as an ailment. And you say, like, well, why does it really matter? Well, the disease classification would lead to greater resource allocation for aging research. You know, just like this recent declaration that obesity is a considered disease, that had a big, their obesity research got a big boost in funding. Well, you know, aging is arguably like one of the most important unsolved problems for humanity, yet less than 0.1% of the National Institutes of Health budget is spent on understanding the aging process, even though aging really is like the leading cause of disease and death. But, you know, few medical textbooks even have a single chapter on the subject. It's been kind of relegated to, you know, this kind of limbo reserved for, like, you know, eccentric whims rather than really kind of serious scientific consideration. And, you know, you think, well, wait a second. You think big pharma, regardless, would invest in it because, like, talk about a blockbuster drug, right? Everybody, right? Everybody would be up for it. But why spend the money on research when it can just be spent on marketing all the unproven anti-aging products they already sell, right? Many of the leading lines of dietary supplements owned by drug companies. They're the ones selling the cosmeceuticals, the age reverse skin creams, all that garbage. It's Sanofi, big drug maker, even partnered with Coca-Cola to come out with some beauty drink, quote unquote, right? So they're already making money hand over fist, preying on the public's gullibility and desperation for anti-aging products. So it's like, why waste money on proving anything actually works? Because people are suckers. They'll buy it anyway.
And actually, to that point, I would be super curious. So, like, because you mentioned like a blockbuster drug for aging, I definitely think most people would want that. I would be really curious though, because I always thought everybody wanted to live forever. Like, I want to live forever. I thought that was just really common. But when I ask a lot of people on the show, they actually don't. And when I ask people, like, in my life, they often don't. So for you, do you want to live forever?
Well, you know, they actually asked that question. I have it somewhere in the book where people were given the choice of asked how long do you want to live? I mean, multiple choice. Do you want to live to 85, 120, 150, or indefinitely? And to my shock, about two-thirds, big majority, said they'd prefer only to live to 85. But when the question was reframed as, how long do you wish to live in guaranteed mental and physical health? Aha! Well, then the most popular answer switched to an unlimited lifespan, right? And that really brings up this concept of health span, which is the period of life spent in good health, free from chronic disease and disability. And so what's the point of living longer if we can't enjoy it vibrantly? And so that's why in my book, I not only talk about lifespan, but also talk about health span.
So it sounds like since you were shocked, you must have been like me, where it's like,
oh my God, as long as I freaking want. That's how long I got shit to do. I don't know about you, but more hours in the day and years on the life.
Sometimes I'll follow up with the second question about health span, and sometimes that changes their mind, but sometimes still people are like, well, it's like they don't know what they would do with that much time. But I'm like, there's so much to do. Like, I just want to keep going.
You know, ask them a day before they're going to die if they really want more time. Right now, they're like, 85 seems so far away. But okay, ask me at 84. Come on. Hopefully, you know, you're living some sort of life where you got stuff that you want to do that you enjoy. There's other people that you can improve their lives. You can do suffering in the world. I mean, there's just so much to live for.
One quick, really specific question about aging. Well, first of all, so men versus women in aging, is there a big difference there? And in particular, because we're going to dive deep into diet, is there a difference in how men and women respond to diet and how that affects their aging? And I also am curious about women having children and aging, how that affects things. So lots of topics.
Lots of topics. So one of the biological constants in the world, one of kind of the best validated data that we know, is show that women live longer than men basically everywhere. And it's been a really interesting research question. I talk all about all sorts of juicy theories in the book as to why that's actually the case. And we're still not actually sure. In terms of different foods, well, there's certainly different conditions. So women experience, you know, menopausal hot flash symptoms, obviously. Often these so-called vasomotor symptoms, such as hot flashes or flushes and night sweats and things. That's something men don't have to worry about. Women don't have to worry about prostate enlargement and prostate cancer. Women have to worry much more about breast cancer, certainly ovarian cancer, et cetera. And so there certainly are very kind of gender specific thing, but overall, like for the organs that they share in common, it's the same recommendations. The same heart healthy diet, the same heart healthy diet and lifestyle for men and women, liver healthy, kidney healthy. Otherwise, biology is very similar. I'm trying to think of any circumstances where, I mean, there's obviously, different foods, but that's, you know, ovary specific, talking about all the things you can do for, you know, dysphoric menstrual cycles and things. But but beyond those arenas, it's pretty much the same for both, although you have different size.
What about like soy?
Oh, yeah. Well, soy is healthier for women than this for men just because they get more benefit from it. Soy is certainly a very misunderstood bean. So I talk a lot about the benefits of soy. So people don't understand there's actually two kinds of estrogen receptors in the body. So they hear, you know, phytoestrogens in soy. They think, oh, estrogens, that's bad. That's going to give me breast cancer or worse than my breast cancer. But there's two types of estrogen receptors. There's phytoestrogens in soy bind to the beta receptors, and our own estrogen binds to the alpha receptors. So the effects of soy on different tissues depends on the ratio of alpha to beta. So estrogen has positive effects on some tissues, negative effects on others. So for example, estrogen is good for the bones, bad for the breast. So ideally, we'd have some kind of what's called a selective estrogen receptor modulator to have estrogen effects in some tissues, but anti-estrogenic effects in others. And that's what soy phytoestrogens do. So they lower breast cancer risk. That's an anti-estrogenic effect. At the same time, they reduce menopausal hot flash symptoms. That's a pro-estrogenic effect. So with soy, you get the best of both worlds. But we should eat legumes, soy, and other beans, chickpeas, lentils, split peas, every day.
With soy, does some of that depend on your gut bacteria and whether or not you produce?
Oh, yeah. Juicy. Equal. So, right. Oh, I love it. So cool. Yeah. So I talk about the microbiome chapter. Basically, some people soy is good for you. Some people soy is great for you. And that's because there's kind of an activation of compound in soy by one's microbiome, but you have to have those activating bacteria. And so you just miss out on some of the benefits if you don't. The only population in the Western world with decent rates of equal production is those eating plant-based diets, presumably because we're basically feeding the bacteria that are making this transition. It used to be a lot of equal production in Japan, since they have the highest soy consumption in the world, averaging, I think, about two servings of soy a day. But even they are starting to, their equal producers are starting to wither away. So the question is, how can we turn from non-equal producer to equal producer? And looks like the best advice we can give is to eat a diet centered around plants.
So those bacteria are ones that can be cultivated through a dietary choice. They're not, you don't have to be born with them.
That is true. Although we have not, there's yet to be an interventional trial to actually show the switch. So it looks like it just takes longer. And yeah, we see that a lot with microbiome studies. In fact, that's why you see so much, I think, confusion in a lot of the microbiome literature, where some studies show one thing, other studies show another, and duration and quantity are the two big things. So you'll see studies comparing like whole grain bread to white bread and see no difference in some kind of outcome. And yeah, but like the difference in fiber, it was like 5 grams. And 5 gram difference, I'm not sure you're going to see in a limited time span. And you can actually do fiber supplement studies where, you know, 10 grams works, but 5 grams just doesn't. Another factor is duration. There's a breakfast cereal study where they randomized people to Rice Krispies or All Bran for breakfast for a year. And for the first 9 months, nothing happened, which is consistent with all the short-term studies, where just that switch was not enough to sufficiently affect kind of the microbiome. But starting at month 9 and increasing through month 12, you saw significant improvements in, insulin resistance, long-term blood sugar control. And that is because, you know, it takes a while to shift the microbiome, particularly when you're making small changes, such that, you know, the more fiber you eat, not only is more the beneficial short-chain fatty acids, the postbiotics created by our fiber feeders, but the more fiber feeders we create. And so it increases our capacity. So, for example, if you give someone who's been just eating like milkshakes and cheeseburgers their whole lives, you give them a whopping dose of fiber, they only benefit a small amount from it because they just don't have enough fiber feeders. I mean, you can maximize out the production of the few bugs you have, but it's growing the production of, you know, making an ecosystem down in your gut that facilitates, you know, where they can just count on, you know, the constant flow of nourishment, that you can really grow your bifidobacteria and acidophilus and these other fiber feeders that have those knock-on beneficial effects. And so you basically increase your machinery of fiber conversion capacity to those postbiotics that we really want by eating more fiber and then continue to eat more fiber. And so to just continue to ramp up. But that's why a lot of these short-term studies just don't show the beneficial effects you'd expect from increasing fiber intake.
I was actually thinking about that concept, not about those foods, but the concept of short-term versus long-term in particular, and how we interpret data, and what does it maybe say about causation correlation? And the example in the book I was thinking about was, you talked about how having, I think it was wine with like a cheeseburger or something, could short-term reduce oxidative stress from the meal, but that long-term, that didn't necessarily pan out. And then on the flip side, having, I think, grape juice short-term didn't seem to do that, but might do long-term. And I was wondering if that was more about causation correlation. And how do we interpret that if we have, you know, a situation where like having some vino with the meal seems to have a beneficial effect in the moment, but how do we know if that is a long-term benefit or not?
Oh, that's a good point. In fact, you know, those indigestible sugars, like raffinose and stachyose in those beans that you're getting rid of with the beano, these are actually what good gut bugs eat, in part. And so you're actually, yes, starving your bugs of those particular compounds. So, I mean, look, you got to eat your legumes, right? Is the centerpiece of every single you know, Blue Zone diet, area of exceptional longevity in history, centering their diets as the primary protein source, some kind of legume. So you got to have them in your diet. The only way you can do that is using something like, you know, at the beginning, until your gut bugs can adapt, then absolutely go for it. But it's not something that you should need to be on long term, as your gut will adapt to it. Basically, what happens is your gas-consuming bacteria are fostered by the gas-producing bacteria, but there's a delay in that middle period where you can have excessive gas and bloating, but that's just because you have yet to, you know, develop the bacteria on the other end that are consuming that same gas. But, I mean, gas is showing fermentation works. You're fermenting fiber, right? When, you know, you're making beer, you're making sauerkraut, it's those little bubbles. Show that stuff is happening. So that's a good thing is the gas production, but that is countered naturally by bugs in your gut. They're like, ooh, methane, this is delicious, and they use it, but it takes a while for the higher gas environment to foster the growth of those gas consumers, so you get the optimal balance so you can eat all the beans you want and not run into problems and net all the benefits.
So we're talking about so many things here that I think my audience in general tends to be a little bit skeptical of or lean away from, because it is a lot of, well, paleo, keto, even carnivore people, things like soy and even legumes, people get hesitant about. So I have so many questions about this topic. And I personally, you mentioned the Blue Zones. I am so haunted by what is the ideal diet for longevity. Super curious your take on some things that we talk about a lot on this show, probably with a slightly different perspective. So this is a good moment for me where to start. So maybe one would be, because we've mentioned protein, and you just mentioned like starting with protein in these diets, but legume-based, so plant-based protein. And in the book, you have this anti-aging 8 list, which I am really excited to hear how actually I'll ask you that really quickly, because it's a big topic to come up with the 8 anti-aging things. Was there a lot in the running? Like, did you have to narrow it down from like 100?
Yeah. In fact, yeah, I think we started 13, something like that.
What were some that didn't make the cut?
Oh my God. I'd have to look at some of the earlier drafts. I think all I did in some cases is just kind of combine two. Like, so I combined xenohormesis and...
Wait, I have it right here. And microRNA manipulation.
Oh, is that the same chapter?
I have it. Yes.
Oh yeah. So those were two initially, and I just kind of put those together because it's kind of this cross-kingdom communication. Basically, the anti-aging is things that just came up throughout the book. So, you know, I go through, you know, in my, part three, where I talk about preserving your bones, bowels, bladder, you know, circulation, hair, hearing, hormone balance, immune function, joint health, mind, muscle, sex life, skin, teeth, vision, et cetera, et cetera. And things just kept popping up, like greens. All the time. Like, oh, you want to preserve your vision? Well, there's lutein, zeaxanthin, all these amount of things. Oh, well, guess what? All of a sudden the nitrates come up, nitrates and greens come up in the sex life chapter. Oh, all of a sudden it comes up in the brain chapter. Even the muscles chapter, right? You can actually randomize people to eat spinach, see a significant improvement in muscle mass, muscle strength, muscle performance. Spinach, who would have thought? And so it's like, so that's how greens make in my anti-aging aid. It's like, okay, well, if there's one thing, it's just kind of, it just hits so many different things at the same time. Same thing with berries. It's just berries came up over and over, came up in cognition, came up in immune function, came up in joint health. Basically, just a way to kind of emphasize, underscore, these are some of the things that, you know, you can, with kind of one fail swoop, affect so many aspects of aging at one time.
What's really interesting, I just interviewed the researchers behind the MIND diet, which is one of the highest studied, if not the highest studied, dietary approach for preventing cognitive decline. They also break down, you get more points for greens specifically and for berries specifically, and just berries, like you don't get points for the other fruits. It really makes me wonder in the entirety of the literature if findings would be different at all if it was always broken down by greens versus other vegetables, and also by berries versus other fruit, because often it's like lumped together. like fruit and vegetables.
Right, right. And not just fruit and vegetables, but even fruit is a huge category. Vegetables is a huge category. So vegetables include some of the healthiest foods on the planet, like kale, and some of the, like, you know, iceberg lettuce.
Although it's good for sleep, I learned in your book.
Which is good for sleep, which is crazy. No, and it's actually relatively high in spermidine. I couldn't believe I saw it on the spermidine list. I was like, what? Iceberg? I shouldn't be so mad. I shouldn't diss iceberg. Look at it. Look at it go. Look at it go. But basically, so there's some components in our diet, like, say, vitamin C, found widely throughout the plant kingdom. And so, you know, basically you could eat almost any plant and you're not going to die of scurvy, right? But there are certain compounds only found in certain foods or certain classes of foods, like sulforaphane in cruciferous vegetables. If you don't eat cruciferous vegetables, you're basically screwed. Now there's I think there's one mushroom that has it, moringa, which some tree in Africa has it. But basically, the only thing in the supermarket you're going to get sulforaphane from is cruciferous vegetables, broccoli, kale, cabbage, bok choy, etc. And so if you don't eat cruciferous vegetables, you are going to miss out on the benefits, even if you eat tons of other vegetables. Same thing with, like, lignans and flax seeds. You know, flax seeds have like 100 times more lignans than any other food. Sesame seeds are not bad, but basically the most concentrated source by far. And you're basically not going to get a lot of lignans unless you are eating flax seeds every day. So that's, you know, goes on the daily dozen. And, you know, turmeric has this curcumin pigment that's really not found anywhere else. And saffron has things not really found anywhere else. And so that's why, you know, it's not enough just to eat plants, just not enough to eat fruits and vegetables, not enough to, you know, we should focus on the healthiest fruits, berries, the healthiest vegetables, dark green leafy vegetables, even cruciferous dark green leafies, just because they're not interchangeable. Now, there is something to be said about dietary diversity. So I talk about, you know, the 50 food challenge, talking about trying to get 50 different plant foods every week. That's because fiber is a catch-all term, which involves literally thousands of different molecules of these indigestible carbohydrates made by plants that can feed our good bacteria, but different fibers feed different gut bugs. And so if you want to have this variety, this richness in your microbiome, then eating lots of different foods can help get you there. And interestingly, some of the fiber supplements like psyllium, Metamucil, isn't fermented at all by our good gut bugs, right? So they can't eat psyllium. So it can kind of bulk up stools for regularity, but doesn't have any of the other fiber benefits we would expect. And so that's why always better to eat whole foods, a variety of whole foods, but there certainly are some foods that are better than others. We should go out of our way to eat them.
Question about the dosage with these foods. I'm curious. So I know at one point in the book, you talk about olive oil being added to a meal and how at a certain threshold, it was beneficial for preventing, I don't remember, some like negative effect from, I think, oxidation or something. And if you had too much olive oil, it actually had a pro-inflammatory effect. And I realize that's olive oil. I'm super curious though, with something like spices, which seem to have a really potent, concentrated mechanism for potential benefits in the body, are the health benefits of spices xenohermetic, or do they involve hormesis, meaning if we have too much of a spice, could it actually be a problem? And I'm selfishly asking this question because I eat so much turmeric and ginger. Like, I don't just sprinkle it on. I'll have like half a, you know, like a spice jar. I'll have like half of that in one meal.
Whoa.
I'm wondering if I'm actually like undoing the benefits.
No. So, I mean, these are not hermetic. I mean, there are some healthy foods like actually cruciferous vegetables. That's a hermetic response. Your body does not like broccoli and will increase its defenses when you eat it. Same thing with green tea. Green tea actually has a pro-oxidant effect so powerfully that your body ramps up its antioxidant defenses such that actually overall you have improved antioxidant status in your body because you drink green tea. So that is certainly true of some things, and that's why you don't want to take green tea extract supplements, which run into liver toxicity, because you can get too high levels, and you can actually overdose cruciferous vegetables, but that's at absolutely humongous doses. I'm trying to think if the spices. No, in fact, some of the beneficial effects of curcumin supplementation are done at doses which are really high, way higher than culinary doses. You can never get that kind of curcumin just, you know, eating turmeric. There are certainly studies that use, you know, like 18 milligrams of curcumin, which is, you know, easy to do, and a spoonful of turmeric, but others use such high levels that you're really not going to be able to get that otherwise. The only concern about drinking...
Well, they haven't met me.
And they haven't met you. Although turmeric has some insoluble oxalates in it, such that if you are at risk for producing urinary kidney stones, oxalate kidney stones, I would not be eating half a jar of turmeric just for that purpose, for that reason. So I have a video about that. I forget exactly how much, but yeah.
Like you said, it's not like it's a hormetic thing where you could.
No. And in fact, some people are taking absolutely huge doses. I'm talking about people, the cancer trials, where they're doing, you know, grams of curcumin a day, which would just be like cups of turmeric.
Okay. Well, so I think I'd be an interesting person. Like I'm an interesting case study because I eat very simply. I only eat whole foods and I eat a ton of, well, you're going to love half of it. I eat a ton of, it's all whole foods, but it's very simple. So I eat a ton of like cucumbers and like I said, like spices. I eat a ton of fruit, but I also eat a ton of lean animal protein. And that works really well for me. And we talk a lot about protein on this show. And so I'm so curious your thoughts on all this because one of your anti-aging eight is protein restriction. And I think it's a topic I've been perplexed by and haunted by for a long time because I hear so much and learn so much about the role of protein and the benefits of protein. And then we also hear about how low protein is anti-aging and methionine restriction, you know, is a good thing. But then for me personally, I do fasting every day as well. So I feel like that kind of maybe counters the IGF-1 and mTOR effects. But so I eat a ton of lean protein and my LDL is like 49, which...
Oh, nice. Gorgeous.
It's interesting that you can eat high animal products and have low LDL.
That must be really lean.
Hey, friends. I'm about to tell you how to get 10% off the ideal coffee when it comes to supporting your health. So if you guys know me, you know I am obsessed with optimizing basically everything I consume, and that especially relates to coffee. Did you know that coffee is one of the most powerful sources of antioxidants in the modern diet? And yet, not all coffee is created equal. Between sourcing, farming practices, roasting, and contaminants, there can be a huge difference in the health impact of the coffee that you drink. That is exactly why I created Glow Coffee. Glow Coffee is a premium, specialty-grade Arabica coffee sourced from sustainable women-led farms in Colombia. It's organically grown, and we third-party test it meticulously, like every single lot, for purity. And what makes Glow especially exciting from a biohacking perspective is that we specifically made it to be rich in chlorogenic acid, or CGA. That's one of coffee's primary, most potent antioxidant compounds that has been studied for its role in metabolic health, inflammation, oxidative stress, and so much more. The elevation levels of the beans, how they're grown, and how they're roasted all affect CGA levels. So we searched high and low to find the perfect beans naturally high in CGA and tested them to confirm that, and then we roast those beans to preserve the CGA content. And then test after that as well. Coffee is already one of the potentially biggest contributors of antioxidants in the human diet, so I designed Glow Coffee to maximize those benefits while keeping it incredibly clean and high quality. And this coffee is so clean. It's grown organically, of course, but then we go even farther than that. We third-party test the beans for almost 100 toxic compounds, including pesticides, heavy metals, and mold. Oh, and perhaps the best part is it is absolutely delicious. We're talking smooth, low bitterness. It's honestly the exact coffee I personally want to drink every single day of my life. It's so bright, smooth, and delicious that it's also perfect black for fasting. No added sweeteners or cream needed. You can also splash it on your face for an antioxidant-rich toner. I do that every single day. After the sauna, after the shower, all the things. I created Glow Coffee because it's really about upgrading one of our most common daily habits into something that truly supports your health and performance. You can get 10% off with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at glowcoffeeco.com. That's 10% off Glow Coffee with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at glowcoffeeco.com. Are you ready to glow inside and out? Fuel your day, illuminate your way. That's glowcoffeeco.com.
Yeah, I don't add any fat. And then I eat, well, sometimes I will have like salmon, which is fatty fish. But what's the question there? The question in there is, what are your thoughts on animal protein when it comes to aging? Maybe we can start there.
Yeah, well, when it comes to protein aging, less, maybe more, right? Reducing protein intake, meaning restricting protein intake down to recommended levels, is the only thing I could find that could help block all 11 of the aging pathways. So it boosts NAD, improves immunity, decreases oxidative stress, inflammation, insulin resistance, as well as the cancer-promoting growth hormone IGF-1. Surprisingly, there is no benefit. Adding extra protein to the diets of older men and women in terms of muscle mass, muscle strength, and muscle performance. Instead, what the excess protein that most Americans get causes a drop in the pro-longevity hormone called FGF-21, a drop in testosterone, a worsening of the age-accelerating hormone mTOR. So we really should strive to stick to the recommended level of 0.8 grams per healthy kilogram body weight, which comes out to be about 45 grams a day for the average height woman, 55 grams a day for the average height man.
Are those studies looking at, are they epidemiological data for people on high protein diets? Are they controlled trials?
Interventional trials. You can randomize people to higher or lower protein, and you can, you know, affect their FGF21, IGF, their, you know, mTOR, easy, right? And, you know, the single greatest life extension you can do in a laboratory animal setting is methionine restriction. Probably, if there was one thing, if you could only choose one thing in terms of longevity intervention, it would be methionine restriction, restricting the intake of this particular amino acid, which is found concentrated in animal proteins. One of the reasons why legumes are the centerpiece protein for every single, you know, blue zone ever documented.
What happens after age 65?
Now, at age 65, we really should probably bump that up to 1.0 grams per kilogram, but of course, sticking to plant-based sources to prevent excess IGF-1 activation.
Okay. What do you think is happening when I like bring on experts and they are saying there's a lot of negatives to low protein and that we really need protein to support muscle as our main organ and our metabolism? Like, why do you think there are these different ideas about protein?
Oh my God. Well, there's this massive protein marketing industry. God, you walk into a store, they have protein fortified water. They have protein. If you want to sell something, you slap high in protein on. I'm surprised Fruit Loops doesn't have a big protein. Now with protein, whatever. It's just a way to sell stuff. I mean, so there's just like ton, you know, the protein, you know, supplement market is just absolutely huge. And so there's just this like social, I don't know. I mean, but if you look at the literature, it's the entire longevity literature is like, you go to like the, you know, Luigi Fantana, Walter Longo, it's cutting down on protein to live longer. I mean, the peer-reviewed medical literature is very clear, but peer-reviewed medical literature often does not have much a contact with kind of like the blogosphere or whatever is happening in the kind of, you know, in the crazy, crazy marketing world. But the literature is really clear. I mean, that's like the one thing you see in the longevity literature. It is protein restriction. That's how you make everything from fruit flies live longer to rats to live longer is like, you know, more power. In fact, the benefits of calorie restriction may be from the protein restriction. The benefits of protein restriction may be actually coming from the methionine restriction. You can replicate many of the benefits of caloric restriction, restricting everything in your diet just by cutting down methionine. I mean, it's really, yeah. I mean, so probably the most powerful thing we can do would be methionine restriction, which is basically can be done either by eating less food, period, or by eating, you know, restricting your protein down to recommended levels. Or switching, even if you keep the same amount of protein, you just switch from animal protein sources to plant protein sources, you can reduce your methionine because legumes have relatively low methionine levels compared to animal products.
Like I said, I'm so haunted by this. And I had Dr. Walter Longo on the show and I told him the same thing about my diet and I wanted to know if he thought by fasting every day, because I do one meal a day, if it was, you know, evening out? Like, was I having the fast and was that countering the whatever my inflammatory potential, IGF-1, mTOR, all the things with high protein? And he said, we just don't know. So,
well, I mean, for you, if you can just measure it, you want to know what your IGF-1 is? You just measure what your IGF-1 is, right?
That's only been on one blood test that I've done. I should do it again.
I mean, so look, I mean, I think I don't know what kind of meat you're eating, but I think most people eat your diet, they'd have high LDL. So that would be bad for them, but not bad for you. Your LDL is beautiful, right? So you can find out. So, I mean, so, you know, just because on average something happens and so you make population recommendations, don't eat this, eat this. But if you eat Twinkies and all of a sudden your numbers all get better, eat Twinkies.
If I add plant fats, actually. So if I do like high coconut oil, which I realize has saturated fat, then my LDL does shoot up.
Oh, absolutely. It's as bad as lard, right? I mean, it's saturated. I mean, yeah. So yeah, any tropical oils, palm oil, palm kernel oil, all do the same thing.
So many things here. Well, speaking of like funding and everything, there's a lot of controversy around the olive oil industry that a lot of funding went into making olive oil like the thing. Do you have thoughts on that?
Well, of course the olive oil industry wants olive oil to be the thing, just like the watermelon industry wants watermelon to be the thing. There's a watermelon promotion board. Just there's the Walnut Commission. It's no surprise, but it's like, well, but who has the power, right? I mean, you compare the watermelon promotion board budget to the, you know, the Egg Council or the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, right? Or the Dairymen. I mean, you know, you can get a sense of where you're getting the kind of, you know, the crazy misinformation from and who has the budget to muddy the waters by, you know, designing studies to have kind of preordained outcomes. And you kind of, you know, put your kind of thumb on the scale. And it's because these foods are, you know, profitable. Think of the ultra-processed food industry, actually created by the tobacco industry back in the 80s when Philip Morris owned Kraft, General Mills, and they started producing. They started making these products. They just flooded the zone with Kool-Aid, and they created all this stuff using the same tobacco industry scientists. And, you know, they are, I mean, if you look at the nutritional literature out, huge industry backlash trying to, you know, dismiss this whole ultra-processed thing. Thankfully, the scientific community is holding strong. It's really one of the most exciting things to see happen in the nutrition community. But I mean, it's just tremendous. I mean, you should see the editorials and, I mean, that's just in the medical literature. I can only imagine what's happening out in the real world with companies trying to somehow argue that these foods aren't bad for you.
I think one of the most frustrating things is things like Coca-Cola or companies where they focus on exercise instead. So they like make exercise seem, I mean, exercise is great, but they kind of like, or they're like, look over here. Like, you know, like don't look at the problem with like our sugar sweetened beverages. Instead, it's that you're not exercising. That's the problem.
Right. Yes. You cannot outrun a bad diet, right? Just because, you know, it takes an hour to burn the calories that you would get consuming in 5 minutes from something like Coca-Cola. And so, but yeah, no. So they funded this whole Global Energy Balance Consortium. That was all Coca-Cola funded because they wanted to, right, to shift the, you know, kind of societal conversation away from, you know, the crappy foods to, oh, you just need more, you know, it's all about sedentary lifestyle. But if you look at, you know, Global Burden Disease Study, the largest study in history of risk factors for disease, death, and disability, number one cause of death in these United States is the American diet, bumping tobacco smoking. Number two, cigarettes only kill about 500,000 Americans every year, whereas our diet kills many more. Physical activity is like seven. Killer number seven. It's bad. What we put in our mouth is the most important thing.
Do you think, especially right now with Ozempic and GLP-1 agonists and everything, where people are actually losing weight, what do you think will be the long-term effects of that? And if people are losing weight on still not so good diets, does it even matter? So like if they're just doing calorie restriction and they're eating less, but they're still eating, you know, processed foods, can they maybe get most of the benefits, or do they really need to be following a whole foods-based diet?
Oh, no. How would we answer that question? You know how we answer that question? Bariatric surgery, right? So what does bariatric surgery do? So let's say you cut out most of your stomach, 90% of your stomach, right? And then what are you eating? You're eating the same crappy diet, but you're eating one-tenth of the same crappy diet, right? Okay, so what happens? What happens to your cancer rates? Dramatic drop. What happens to your lifespan? Dramatic increase. What happens to cardiovascular disease risk? Goes down. Why? Because excess body fat is so devastating to one's health, shaving, you know, 6 to 7 years off your lifespan. I don't care if these drugs, you know, literally shaved years off your lifespan could still, you know, come out positive in the end, if indeed they actually cured obesity, which they don't actually do. But if they did, then it'd be a different story. You know, bariatric surgery has a fatality rate on the operating table about 1 in 1,250 people. Don't make it off the table. Even though there's such high mortality, just because it's, you know, there's a risky patient population, it's major surgery. Okay, but even with that, you still live longer. Those at the same weight who do bariatric surgery versus those who don't, because of the devastating consequences of obesity. So that's why, you know, so, you know, yes, they talk about how, yeah, Ozempic, these GLP-1 agonists increase your risk of thyroid cancer, probably increase your risk of pancreatic cancer, blah, blah, blah. You don't want cancer? Well, then you don't want obesity. That's what you don't want. Obesity increases risk of 18 different kinds of cancer. So if you lost enough weight, you get all the thyroid, you know, pancreatic cancer you want. You still get less cancer overall, still be less likely to die from cancer. Now, this is all assuming these drugs work. And unfortunately, what you see is they work short term, but then they stall out. So all the studies have been done after a year, weight loss stops. So the 4-year studies been done so far. You know, they lose the, they have this dramatic weight loss which stalls after a year, and then literally they don't drop a pound. So they're injecting drugs every single week for the next 3 years, don't lose a pound. And these are forever drugs. Why? Because if you stop taking the drugs, all of a sudden that weight you initially lost will come raging back. But in every single major study done to date, people on average started out obese and they ended up obese when the drug stopped working. So you start out obese and you end up obese. Now, you're still less obese, but you're still taking these drugs, spending, you know, $1,000 a month every day for the rest of your life, not every day, every week, for the rest of your life, just to maintain your obese status. Otherwise, you'll get more obese. And so people don't understand that. And so you have no more benefit in terms of weight loss, but you do continue to experience the risk side effects, short-term, mostly gastrointestinal, long-term, have these issues with thyroid cancer and bowel obstruction and pancreatitis and kind of on down the list.
I'm super curious in the studies if it would be any different if they would separate it out by people and their food choices, what they're eating during the weight loss. And or I'm really curious about the effects of a high protein, calorie restricted diet to maybe support muscle and not have the inflammatory effects of the protein because it's calorie restricted. I just wonder if that's an approach. Like a lot of people will do like this PSMF approach, protein sparing modified fast, where they're basically eating just lean protein. Yeah, I don't know if you have thoughts on that concept.
Conserving protein during weight loss, conserving your muscle mass during weight loss is not about how much protein you're eating. I mean, if you have excess protein, your body just turns it into, you know, carbs and fat. I mean, you have no way to store protein. And if your body doesn't just make muscles because it wants to make muscles because it needs to make muscles. Why? Because you're doing strength training, because you're doing resistance training. That's how you make more muscles. And so that, I mean, so resistance exercise is the best way to prevent the loss of muscle mass during weight loss, which typically is about 25%. 25% of people on caloric restriction, 20%, you know, 1 out of every 4 pounds you lose on the scale is actually lean mass. But actually for the Ozempic drugs, it's 40%, 40%. And that's why part of the Ozempic face reaction is not just loss of fat from the face, you're actually losing muscle from the face. And so what do? You need to exercise. Are these people doing strength training when they're being prescribed these drugs? Unfortunately, they're not. Typically.
Going back to the some of the things that you touched on in the food discussion, I love, okay, here's a question I'm haunted by is nitrates, nitrosamines. So it's fascinating when you talk about it in the book because, you know, we hear about the health benefits of these from produce, but also the potential for them to turn into cancer-causing compounds. And is it possible that that happens when you combine it with animal products, meaning could having produce actually, you know, become a cancer-causing compound in the right setting?
Yeah. Isn't that ironic? So people who are like doping with beet juice for athletic performance, if they're then having a meat meal, I mean, that's that nitrate is going back up, forming nitrite in their mouth. You know, it's being excreted in their salivary glands. And when that nitrite hits the amines and amides in their stomach, because you just had, you know, the turkey sandwich for lunch, then you can actually create these nitrosamines. So that's why it's really only safe to do this kind of nitrate, you know, ergogenic nitrate strategy if you're eating a plant-based diet, because the, you know, the vitamin C and other plant-based nutrients actually prevent that from forming. They don't have the amides and amines that create this problem. So nitrites are not carcinogenic, right? The nitrites that are added to cure meat. But what happens is the nitrites combine with the amides and amines in animal protein and create these nitrosamines and nitrosamides. Now, those are carcinogenic, which is the reason why cured meat, processed meat, bacon, ham, hot dogs, lunch meat, sausage is a known human carcinogen, causes cancer in people, colorectal cancer, which is the number one cancer killer among non-smokers. Now, red meat, like beef and pork, is just a probable cancer, probably causes colorectal cancer in people, but processed meat is considered a known human carcinogen, a so-called group 1 carcinogen.
Hi, friends.
Would you like to have the most epic eating experience? I'm talking eradicate bloating and better absorb your nutrients. If so, you need digestive enzymes. These are one of my most favorite supplements out of everything I take, and I truly cannot imagine my life without them. Digestive enzymes are key to break down your food into usable nutrition and to stop things like bloating, digestive distress, constipation, all the things. That's why I created Avalon X Digest, and you can get 10% off with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at avalonx.us. You can also get a subscription and save 15%, which you can pause or cancel at any time. Friends, I worked so hard to create the perfect blend of enzymes for Avalon X Digest. It's a full-spectrum, plant-based enzyme blend with proteases to help you break down protein, amylase for carbs, lipase for fats, cellulase for fiber, and so much more. In fact, there are 13 different types of enzymes in this blend. I cannot tell you how many people have told me that when they take Avalon X Digest, they experience no digestive distress with meals. These are truly game changers. And for any of you guys looking to up your protein intake, Avalon X Digest will help you actually break down and assimilate your protein so you get more protein from your meals. I wanted to create the highest potency enzymes so that you get all of these benefits when you eat with no problematic fillers or ingredients. Avalon X Digest is also tested multiple times for purity and potency, comes in glass bottles, and is truly the best enzymes on the market. And again, you can get 10% off with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at avalonx.us.
When meat has like celery, what is it, like celery seed extract as?
Celery juice. Yeah, fermented celery juice. Oh, slimy.
Is that still going to be a problem?
Yeah. Even the meat industry understands that this is really misinforming people. So basically, okay, so people understand that, oh, nitrates are, added nitrates bad for you. Okay. So you will see, but you look, go to the store, you'll see uncured pork, uncured bacon, uncured ham, no nitrites added. And then there's always an asterisk. Look at the asterisk. What does the asterisk says? It's just, except that provided in, you know, fermented celery juice or except that added in seasoning or something. Okay. So what's in celery? Nitrates, right? Vegetable nitrates. What with that fermentation process, there are bacteria that fix the nitrogen and turn the nitrates into nitrites. So basically, they are adding what? Nitrites. But they just don't have to use the word technically. So they can say no nitrites added, which is not true because that's what's in fermented celery juice. I mean, it's outrageous. And so it would be expected to have the same effect, the same carcinogenic effect. And so it's just slimy. But what do you expect from an industry that's making a carcinogenic product? You expect them to be like, oh, we all of a sudden care about people's health. Outrageous. It's just a marketing ploy.
And so to double clarify, because you talked about this, but to really clarify, so if I have a animal-based meal that is going to problematically create these nitrosamines, does that mean adding, like eating celery with it actually creates a problem? Or you said, are there protective compounds that prevent that from happening?
Well, so it's not. So then it's between the nitrites and the animal-based meal. In the celery are nitrates. There are bacteria on your tongue that turn nitrates into nitrates. But when you just eat celery, very few of those nitrates are turned into nitrates. But what happens is your body then absorbs the nitrates and concentrates it in your salivary glands and then spews the nitrates onto your tongue because it knows that there are bacteria on there. They're going to turn to nitrites. And that is actually how you get this nitrogen oxide effect, which is nitric oxide effect, which has this performance enhancing benefits. Not only increases blood flow, but actually improves your ability, your mitochondria, to extract energy from oxygen. You get more energy from each breath thanks to the nitric oxide, which comes from the nitrates originally from vegetables. Okay, that takes a few hours, right? It takes like, so you eat your spinach salad or your beets or your beet juice, I think it was like an hour and a half before your 5K. Okay, and so that's time for the body to take it, absorb it, dump it in your salivary glands, and let your bacteria do its magic. So it's not having the celery. So it's having the celery and then eating meat an hour and a half after the celery, not with the celery, but an hour and a half after. That would be the problem.
So if you have them at the same time, does the timeline just not line up for that to happen?
Yeah, doesn't line up. So you're just mixing nitrates with amides and amines and nothing happens.
Oh, that's so interesting. Okay, that's complicated. Okay. And then what about, you mentioned spermidine. I was really, okay, because spermidine, I feel like, is one of those supplements I kept hearing about for quite a long time. Like, oh, it's like this anti-aging longevity wonder of a something. And I was a little incredulous about it. In your book, you talked about this study where they looked at all these different foods, and like the one thing that was the thing was spermidine. I know I didn't say much information there.
Out of all food components, right? The one thing about one's diet most associated with longevity over time was spermidine. Beat out everything else. In fact, we talked about methionine restriction in terms of the most powerful intervention to expand lifespan. But in terms of what you can add, what's the greatest longevity ever for any molecule on kind of a safe list? I mean, there's some things that you don't want to take, but in terms of there's a database of all longevity associated compounds, and in the small subset with fewer side effects, spermidine has the longest life expectancy extension ever for any molecule. Amazing. That's why we got to eat wheat germ. But it's amazing that you knew about it. I'd never even heard of spermidine. You're obviously, you know, kind of steeped in the longevity area. But before I sat down to write How Not to Age, I had never even heard of it. But oh my God, what? And so all of a sudden I'm eating wheat germ. I'd never eaten wheat germ before. I'm eating a lot more tempeh than I was before. And because it's so critically important to shoot for that 20 milligrams of spermidine a day.
Yeah, honestly, your book made me take it more seriously. I was like, oh, I need to think about this. Although, wasn't there also a story about the naked mole rat that related to spermidine?
Oh, yeah. That may be one of the reasons why naked mole rats have such extraordinary longevity is because they don't see the decline in spermidine that you see in all other species.
So, but taking it as a supplement, though, versus getting it from your food, is there a big difference there?
Well, see, but it's funny. When you look at the supplements, it's just wheat germ in a capsule. Right. When it says spermidine, it'd be actually look at the list of ingredients. They're just putting wheat germ in a capsule and they're charging you like, you know, a 10,000% markup or something. It's literally just wheat germ. So just eat some wheat germ. I mean, it's funny. I was so funny that I couldn't actually find the actual spermidine because there's no point. It's so concentrated. I mean, wheat germ, they're just like, well, just put wheat germ in a pill. All right, fine. If people want to take capsules of wheat germ, they're just, you know, wasting a lot of money.
I'm actually surprised there's not a spermidine diet book yet that has people eat high spermidine foods.
I tell you, they just got to change the name or something. If it was any other name,
we got a branding problem.
it's got a branding problem. But if it was any other name, it would absolutely be the huge thing, right? But it's just like no one wants to talk about it.
Isn't it called that though? Wasn't it found in sperm originally?
Yeah. So it was first discovered in sperm actually by Leeuwenhoek, the guy who invented the first microscope, and all of a sudden could see things that no one else could see. He was the first one to see sperm, first one to see cells. And so he had all these slides of sperm, semen sitting around on his, you know, in his office, as one does. And he found these crystals starting to form. Evidently, he didn't have, you know, he wasn't good about, you know, cleaning up. And he was like, wow, what are these weird crystals? And that it was spermidine. And so only later did we realize that spermidine is found throughout the body. In fact, it was later independently discovered as a compound. They called it neurodine because they found it in nerves. And then they called another compound they found, said, oh, let's call this musculamine, a new fancy compound found in muscles. Then only later did they realize, oh, musculamine, that's just spermidine. Neurodine, it's just spermidine. So the naming rights defaulted to the less palatable original, but it's actually found throughout the body. It was just discovered there. If they first discovered it in nerves, they would have called it neurodine. And then when they then discovered it in semen, they'd be like, oh, that's just neurodine in semen. But unfortunately, yeah, it all started that way.
Wow. Okay. So it's not necessarily more concentrated in sperm than other places.
Well, I mean, because spermidine is so important as a DNA protector, all your DNA in your body needs protection. But guess what needs extra protection is obviously your gametes, in terms of passing on your genes. So no, it's highly concentrated. Cosmo likes to run columns about how concentrated it is, but you know, but that's on like a per calorie basis or something. So, but there's not as much as Cosmo would like you to believe.
Similar concept where we're finding these, you know, really interesting molecules in the body that are doing things that we didn't realize. So we mentioned it earlier, microRNA. What is going on here?
Oh my God, how cool is that? In fact, guess what? 2 weeks ago, just won the Nobel Prize in Medicine. microRNAs.
Wait, really?
Yeah. This year, the 2024 Nobel Prize in Medicine went to the people that discovered microRNAs. And so it's like, I called it.
This is a moment.
Yeah, no. Very cool. Yeah. So microRNAs, so this is one of the areas that I had never heard of because it wasn't even discovered by the time I graduated medical school. So I completed my training before the world even knew about it. Then they discovered it, and the discoverers just got the Nobel Prize. So, I learn as much writing these books as many people do reading these books, just because, look, this is all new to me. It's not like I was taught about this in medical school. But anyway, so microRNAs represent a cross-kingdom communication pathway between animals and plants and us that we can use to our advantage, and explains just some of the effects that different foods have on us that we normally had ascribed all sorts of other things. But it's like, oh my God, no, it's actually, these are modulators of gene expression that can be transmissible through food and a way that we communicate with bacteria and vice versa. We communicate with plants we eat and vice versa, or the animals we eat. Really kind of extraordinary. So the reason that we have benefits from eating broccoli may not just be because I like the good stuff in broccoli, like the phytonutrients for furfane, but because there are these molecules that actually affect the way our DNA is expressed. But the reason it's so monumental is it's actually the challenge is the central dogma of biology, which is that, DNA leads to, messenger RNA meets the protein, kind of one gene, one protein. That's just how it worked. And, 90% of the DNA was just junk because it didn't do anything. It was just like some kind of viral leftover or something, kind of the dark matter of the genome, till we realized, it's actually not. It's actually doing stuff. It's making these microRNAs, which then go and affect the transcription and function and production of proteins throughout the body. It's this incredible level, extra added level of complexity. And we can use it to our advantage through diet and actually explain some the benefits of herbal medicines and all sorts of things. Absolutely amazing. It was one of my favorite things about that I learned in How Not to Age. And it's still such kind of early stages in terms of our understanding.
And so what is the difference between the microRNAs in plants versus animals? And when we take them in, do they reach our bloodstream? And also, does our body treat microRNA differently if it's endogenous versus exogenous?
Well, that's the thing. So when we're talking about microRNA, they are micro, right? The first microRNA, 22 letters long, right? In the four-letter RNA alphabet, right? These are absolutely tiny basic molecules. So it takes like a stretch of DNA, like to make a protein, takes a stretch of DNA thousands of letters long, just to kind of give you a sense, right? So thousands of letters long. Okay, but microRNAs, like only about 20 letters long. And so there aren't that many ways to make microRNAs. And so like you can have a broccoli microRNA, which is literally the exact same sequence, the same word, right, in the alphabet. And so your body cannot distinguish between a broccoli mRNA or a pig mRNA and the one that's doing things within our body. And it's just because they're so basic. And the reason, and that it's exciting from a research point of view, because we can make them from scratch. We can be like, we want to know if the broccoli microRNA is actually doing this thing. Well, we can literally make it from scratch chemically, create the microRNA, no broccoli associated with it ever, and give that to people and see if we can replicate the effects, just like we can replicate some of the damaging effects of bad, microRNAs found, like some of the bovine microRNAs in dairy. And so it's just, it's not specific to aging, but microRNAs we now regulate, known as a major regulator of all cellular pathways. And so it just makes sense because it's just something that is just the way our body works. But I talk about how, the very first microRNA discovered was in the, C. elegans, this little roundworm. And what did it do? Regulated lifespan. Very first microRNA, you add a little extra, extends their life, cuts it down, and shortens their life. And turns out the target of that microRNA was this, it's called DAF16, which is basically the worm equivalent of FOXO, which can confer like immortality to certain primitive animals, one of the most important genetic determinants of extreme longevity in humans. And so basically by blocking the repression of this longevity gene, the microRNA had this life-extending effect. So from the very first discovery of microRNAs, it's all about lifespan and aging, and now we just know it does so much other stuff.
It's so fascinating. You talk about how it could be a way that different parts of the body, you know, communicate with other parts of the body. And I'd be really curious if they studied like the longest lived animals. Like, I wonder if like jellyfish, or going back to that naked mole rat, I wonder if there's stuff to learn from microRNA in them. Like, what if we eat a jellyfish?
It's difficult to study. And I just got over saying how easy it is to study. But the problem is that they're such simple molecules that contamination is a real issue. Since everything, every living thing makes microRNAs, so every single bug, every single bacteria, every single, food that comes in a lab basically has microRNAs. It's just contamination everywhere. It's like when they tried to start doing studies on lead. The reason it was so hard to nail down the lead contamination as a concern for brain damage stuff, because lead is everywhere. So lead is in everything. So it's very difficult to make like a low lead control group, just because it was so kind of, and so that's why, and so there's a lot of kind of spurious results that have been retracted from the literature where we thought microRNAs did something, but no, someone had just brought in a salad and it just contaminated the bench. I mean, yeah, it's crazy stuff. So yeah, still kind of early stages, lots of cool controversy, but a lot of cool interventional studies where they're like, oh, this herb does this. Oh, this herb has lots of microRNAs. Let's just give the microRNAs and poof, you can actually replicate the herb's effects just with this little microRNA. So the way the herb was working was not because it had some cool phytochemical or something. No, it was working by actually changing the way we express our genes through this communication pathway. Absolutely so cool.
For the Nobel Prize, in what aspect? Just their work with microRNA?
Just the discovery. Their discovery. It was such a monumental thing to discover this whole field. Now, it still took a while to actually get the Nobel. But, you had to make sure that it really was a thing and that it was so important as we thought it was. But as the research, developed to a point, they're like, oh my God, these people deserve a Nobel Prize. And they just got it.
So, so interesting. Okay, a question that I started at the beginning and I don't think we answered yet, and it's coming back to the fertility, women and fertility and having kids. I'm so fascinated by this because I don't personally think I'm ever going to have kids, and I'm wondering if that hurts or hinders my longevity potential.
Oh, yeah. Wasn't that an interesting discussion in the book? And it was kind of weird and counterintuitive. If I remember,
I think it was that women who have children later live longer, but the kids don't live as long.
There's all the sorts of, so there was having more kids and less kids, and then having kids earlier and then later. And it did opposite things on the benefits of the kids versus the parents. And I remember having to tease that out. And I forget how I would have to reread that section. But it was a really interesting thing. And then it was like, well, is it just kind of the genetic ability to have lots of kids that's helping? Or is it actually having the kids that does something good? But it was fascinating. However,
I just wrote, women having children tend to live longer, but their kids don't live as long. Hi, friends. I am so excited to tell you about something that I am obsessed with that can revolutionize your health, help with stress levels, support longevity, and really help you when you go out and are having a bit of wine or drinks or all the things. And I'm going to tell you how to get $100 off. So I've been talking about the role of NAD in our health for so long. NAD stands for nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide. It is a coenzyme that is involved in so many processes in our body, including energy production and DNA repair. And it is depleted by things like stress, aging, lack of sleep, alcohol, and of course,
too much partying. In fact, a lot of researchers believe that declining NAD levels is one of the key factors in aging. That's why I have been really interested in boosting and supporting NAD levels, and I have tried all the things. You can take precursors to NAD called NR and NMN. I still take NMN. However, I am much more alert by directly giving your body NAD. And historically, the most common way to do that that is accessible to people was through NAD IVs and NAD shots. I actually never did an NAD IV for a few reasons. One, they are extraordinarily expensive. Two, I've been doing the shots, which I liked because they were easy to do. That said, they always made me feel a little bit unwell right afterwards. And I've heard that the IV makes a lot of people feel unwell. So if the shots were making me feel unwell and that was going into the muscle first as like a barrier, I can't even imagine what putting it straight into my bloodstream would have done. Plus with the IVs, you have to sit there for potentially hours. So basically IVs were a no-go for me. So like I said, I was doing the shots, but I was like, I wish there was an easier way to do this. Then a company called Ion Layer reached out to me. Oh my goodness, friends, I am so obsessed. So they make transdermal NAD patches, and they have studies showing that these patches actually boost your NAD levels. And what's so amazing is you put on a patch. It's super easy to put on. I have a video on my Instagram about how you do it. You basically get this patch thing with like a negative side and a positive side. You put saline on one side, you mix up the NAD with some sterile water and the NAD that they give you on the other side, then you stick it to your arm or wherever you want to put it. You put a super cool black patch over it, kind of like how you put the patches over CGMs. And then what's amazing is there are no side effects. You don't feel unwell from it, and it lasts for 14 hours. And it's so easy. You can do it at home and then you can really decide when you want to do it. So with the shots, I was doing them once a week and I was trying to do them before going out. With this patch, now I put on the patch before going out and it makes me feel so good. It really helps the next day from any alcohol recovery that you may need. And they look pretty awesome with my outfits, not gonna lie. I am obsessed with these patches. I just want everybody to know about them, and they are so much more affordable than the shots or the IVs. If you want to boost your NAD levels, support anti-aging, help with your stress, help with lack of sleep, and or optimize your partying, you need these patches, friends. And I'm so excited because working with the company has been amazing and they are giving you guys $100 off, which is incredible. So to get that discount, just go to melanieavalon.com/ionlayer. That's Ionlayer, and use the coupon code Melanie Avalon to get $100 off your first order. I cannot recommend these enough. I'm going to use them for the unforeseeable future, probably for the rest of my life. It's literally just become part of my arsenal now. Like when I'm getting ready to go out, usually once a week, put on my NAD patch. And even if I don't go out that week, I still like to do one once weekly. Oh, P.S. They're also amazing for traveling. You guys know I'm not a big traveler. I've been doing more traveling recently, and I wear these on the plane there and back. Game changer. Although it's really fun at TSA, especially because I already opt out and don't go through the scanner thing. So they already are suspicious. And then they're like, what's that on your arm? And I'm like, it's NAD. And then they're like, what's that? And then I'm like, it's a coenzyme in your body that's involved in a lot of metabolic processes and energy production and DNA repair. And then they just look at me really weird, but it's fine. It's totally fine. So again, that's melanieavalon.com/ionlayer to get $100 off your Ion Layer kit. It comes with 6 patches, totally the way to go for boosting NAD levels, and I cannot recommend it enough. MelanieAvalon.com/IonLayer with the coupon code MelanieAvalon for $100 off. I hear all different things because I ask that question a lot to people because I'm so interested by it, and people seem to have different opinions. But well, also another fertility question, what are your thoughts on the potential reduced fertility rates in societies like Loma Linda?
Oh, yeah. Fascinating. Okay. Oh, so I found the section talking about. So, yeah, the proportion of women having their first age after age 35 has increased tenfold, right? So having kids later. So women are having kids later in general, and that induces a longevity penalty on their children, as those born to older mothers don't tend to live as long. But women having children later tend to live longer themselves. For example, female centenarians 4 times more likely to have children after age 40 than women who died in their 70s. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that delaying kids will make you live longer, because, for example, smoking is a co-founder. However, then there's suggestion that, you know, some biological changes in pregnancy may actually have a rejuvenating effect, kind of like a parabiosis mechanism, like bathing the blood of babies, but not in a can't count as battery sort of way. And so it turns out, so to sift through the possibilities, researchers study the longevity of brothers of women who gave birth after age 45 and that of their wives. All right. So the brothers with late fertile sisters lived longer, but their wives did not. So this suggests the genetic robustness cause rather than a rejuvenation effect. But the fact that the longevity benefit didn't extend to the lives suggests it's not just like a co-founder, like socioeconomic status or something. So it's just that women who have kids later are just have the genes that allow them to do that, which also allow them to live longer. And so there's no reason to delay kids.
Basically, because they have the ability to have the kids later, genetically, there's something there that's...
They're just more genetically robust that also happens to help longevity. So there's nothing we can do in terms of interventional, in terms of a modifiable risk factor.
I would just think because, and this is just me thinking about it sort of casually, but because the purpose of the female is seemingly to have children, I just wonder if not having children, then your body's like, you know, waiting still to have children. So maybe it's upregulating some anti-aging pathways. I don't know. That's what I tell myself. But yeah, it's really interesting. So what about the fertility with Loma Linda? And thank you for looking that up.
Yeah, so there was a semen analysis at Loma Linda, right? So it was the only surviving blue zone on planet Earth that raised a question about sperm quality. And so, for example, so the vegetarians had about 25% lower sperm count, still within the normal range, but lower. And same thing with the vegans, though wasn't significantly so, but there's just fewer vegans in the study. But so overall suggests decreased fertility. And so, yes, it could just be a fluke, blah, blah, blah. But I mean, it could actually make sense because there's just this evolutionary trade-off between fertility and lifespan. God, we've known for over a century, right? So you could take a finely tuned laser and like destroy the gonads of, you know, roundworms, and they extend lifespan when they're not, reproducing. And the same thing with fruit flies, right? There's this priority between reproduction to survival, right? Once you're not reproducing anymore, you can take more of your resources and put it into survival. And boy, do we see that with spaying and neutering our pets. So sterilized dogs live about 20% longer than intact dogs. Spayed female cats, 40% longer. Neutered male cats, 60% longer. Your cat will live 60% longer neutered than unneutered. Talk about just a huge lifespan increase. And so it's like, well, wait a second. What about eunuchs? And indeed, eunuchs seem to live about 25% longer than non-castrated men. In fact, we used to sterilize the so-called feeble-minded back in the 1950s, something that was actually proved by the Supreme Court as part of this kind of eugenics thing at the time, which Germans stole from us. And so we actually have these kind of natural experiments where these mental institutions where castrated men lived on average 14 years longer than men with their testicles intact in the same hospital. So again, this kind of there appears to be this kind of reproduction survival trade-off. And for kind of the equivalent in women, the later girls start their periods, the longer they tend to live. Each year later associated with lower risk of dying from heart disease, cancer, stroke. So the lowest mortality, really, if you don't start menstruating until like 15, that's really where the lowest is. Same thing with breast development. Earlier breast development increased breast cancer risk later in life. And, you know, lower risk of cancer is kind of across the board. You know, so a century ago, menarche, first menstruation, was like 17. Now the average age is less than 12. Age of breast development dropped 3 months per decade over the last half century. Now we're down like 9 or 10 years old. We have to keep changing the textbook definition of so-called premature puberty because all of a sudden it's like normal. And this may have to do with IGF-1, you know, because it depends how much meat you eat in terms of when you begin menstruating. But this could have something to do with some of the persistent pollutants and things. But yeah, it's just an absolute fascinating field. I do not recommend self-castration for, I feel like, you know, Brian Johnson is one scalpel away from his next experiment. But I really think we need more data before taking such drastic measures.
that actually really relates to what we were talking about with the women. On the one hand, that might be in favor of not having children, maybe. If there's this inverse correlation between fertility and aging.
Well, but you can be fertile and not use that fertility.
Right. So how does that line up? So how does infertility relate to longevity, and how does fertile but not?
So what would be interesting is if women undergoing early hysterectomies lived longer. That I'm surprised we don't, like, not just hysterectomies, taking out the uterus, but typically when they take out the uterus, often they take out the ovaries if the woman doesn't want to get pregnant. And so it'd be interesting if they live longer. I'm surprised that those studies haven't been done, or at least I didn't run across them. I'm surprised. There have to be such studies. I just don't think I ran across any.
But the infertility does correlate to longevity?
Well, it depends what the infertility, I mean, so is...
Depends on the cause.
Right. I mean, there's this presumption that the same kind of things that there's this kind of this like seesaw effect, that things that are good for our longevity may be bad for our fertility, and things that are good for our fertility are bad for our longevity, these kind of pleiotropic effects where... You know, genes that get us to, that speed us towards puberty to increase our fertility may not be good. So later on in life, but evolution doesn't care about later in life. It just wants us to pass along those genes. And so what may be good earlier on may be bad later. We see that with all sorts of things, from Alzheimer's risk to the mTOR thing. Yeah. So, I mean, it's possible. So, like, you know, caloric restriction, you know, is not good for reproduction, right? Kills your libido. You know, like the famous, Minnesota starvation studies, you know, they cut their calorie intake in half, completely lost their libidos. But, you know, that was severe calorie restriction in the context of nutrient insufficiency, which is not the way to do it.
Yeah. Cause it wasn't that calorie restricted, right? It was like
cut in half, 50%. That's some severe calorie restriction.
I guess when I think severe, I think like people doing like 500 calorie diets, but I think it was like 1300 or something.
Right. So you can do a 500 calorie diet for a few weeks, but I mean, these people were looking like concentration camp victims because they were on this constant calorie restriction for months.
Okay. Yeah. That's so interesting about the fertility. What about the slowed metabolism? Is that another one where it's kind of like a seesaw? Like, we hear all the benefits.
Right. You think about things that you always talk here about boosting metabolism. This is great because it boosts metabolism, right? Because you want to burn calories quicker, right? But the candle that burns twice as fast burns half as long. So basically, what we want to do is actually slow down our resting metabolic rate in terms of longevity. And we can do that through methionine restriction. We can do that through a bunch of other ways.
Plants,
yeah. We do that through eating lots of nitrates and things. But would it make you, more likely? So you eat a lot of greens and all of a sudden your resting metabolic rate goes down. Does that mean you're going to gain weight easier? Well, if you eat a lot of greens, probably not, right? But if you eat a lot of greens and Twinkies, you will gain more weight than if you just eat a lot of Twinkies.
So I think your last anti-aging one on the anti-aging eight, I have to applaud you because you mentioned earlier about how I'd heard of spermidine, prior to this. So a big thing in the biohacking world is NAD and the debates about NR versus NMN. And I personally was doing NAD injections for a while. Now I do patches. Your overview of NAD in your book is the deepest dive I have experienced. I was really impressed. So I'm super curious where you land personally in the NAD debate, and do you supplement NR or NMN or do IV NAD, or what do you think about NAD?
Yeah, that was a big question going in, and boy, was it a mess. I mean, it's just huge, right? It's just this alphabet soup, right? There's NA, NAM, NMN, NR, NAD, NADA, tryptophan, blah, 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 on down the list. So basically, in short, so I go through the pros and cons of each one. All the, eight precursors.
Yeah, you had more than I even realized. I was like, whoa, who knew?
Well, I mean, some just fail, for kind of obvious reasons or cause nasty side effects, blah, 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 and don't make anybody money, right? You know, something like niacin, just absolutely dirt cheap. So you're never going to see an ad for it but the two ones you can make money off of that you hear a lot about, NR and NMN, in short, NR, has been demonstrated to be relatively safe but not effective, and neither safety nor efficacy have been established for NMN. In fact, blindly overloading the system with NAD precursors may not be the best way to restore NAD levels, since the body seems way too, or at least the human body, seems way too smart to allow such a kind of blunt incursion to affect tissue levels. So these supplements really just kind of a profit-making distraction for more natural approaches. And I talk about, look, there are ways. I mean, so the NAD, we really do want to boost NAD levels in our tissues. The problem is there has never been a single study in normal human beings that don't have some weird muscular, genetic muscular dystrophy, never single study ever showing any NAD precursor, NAD boosting supplement, increasing tissue levels. You can increase blood levels, but increasing tissue levels happens in mice and rats, and they have these miraculous benefits. Showing if we actually could increase NAD levels in our tissues, it would have all these miraculous, but we don't have the miraculous benefits and our tissue levels don't go up, which makes sense. Okay, but there are actually ways we can increase NAD in our tissues. And it's called exercise, right? So that's one way. So we boost NAMPT, which is the enzyme that actually makes NAD. How do we do that? We do that through exercise. And then the other two ways are to decrease excess NAD degradation by suppressing the two main NAD consuming enzymes, PARP1 and CD38, which are involved in reducing oxidation and inflammation respectively. And so we just, by reducing the amount of oxidative stress in our body, eating lots of antioxidant-rich foods, and reducing production of free radicals by, you know, not standing in traffic and all, there's all sorts of ways we can reduce our exposure to free radical generation. And eating an anti-inflammatory diet decreases the need of this pro-inflammatory enzyme and the DNA repairing enzyme to do their thing because there's less DNA damage. And so, but it's like, well, that's not very sexy. Exercise? Who, you know, how are we going to make money selling exercise? This is bullshit. Yeah, it's just, you know, I think the failure really should be expected given the complexity of NAD physiology. I mean, it's just so many multiple precursors, production pathways, recycling routes, consuming enzymes. It's just, you know, it's just, I mean, maybe we'll come up with some way to do it eventually, but until then, we have exercise, reducing oxidation inflammation.
Have you done an IV or anything?
I have not done, no.
Yeah, it doesn't feel good doing it.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, the actual experience is like not fun.
Is it? What do you experience?
So, I've done the shots and they made me feel like tight-chested and just really unwell for a little bit.
So, what are they injecting you with? Literally, like NAD? Because NAD isn't really a stable molecule.
Yeah. So, the way you can get direct NAD is through IM injections or the IV and the drip. I never did a drip because it's really expensive. And I was like, I don't want to pay that much money to feel really unwell for hours, because it can take people hours to do it because they have to do it so slow. But it's kind of like, if it's making you feel that way, I don't know that that's a good thing. Like, you know, maybe your body's a little bit intuitive.
But then, no, but that's what these studies show, is that your body's intuitive. Your body's not stupid. Your body sees all these NAD precursors like, screw this, right? And it just, unfortunately, some of the ways that it shunts them off, you know, leads to methyl depletion, all these other things, right? It's like there's actually negative side effects of the byproducts from these excess precursors that your body has to get rid of, and that's been never exposed to in the past at those kind of levels. So you get the sirtuin suppression, methyl depletion. And so, yeah, I mean, it's not just like, oh, yeah, maybe the research isn't in yet, but like, what's the harm? What do you mean, what's the harm? There's there's real potential. So I talk about the downsides of using this, includes, you know, certain inflammatory conditions and infections, certain cancers. And so it's just, it's not worth it till we know more.
I will say, I do love the patches, which are just straight NAD, and it's through the skin, and I've only experienced benefits from that. I don't get any of the negative feelings, and it's not the precursors, it's just the actual NAD.
NAD, and NAD gets through the skin. I mean, it's a charged molecule. How is it getting through the skin?
Mm-hmm. You mix it yourself. It uses those iono patches, I think, where it's, you're like, mix the saline and then you mix the NAD, and then it's like on these two different charges and you patch it to your skin. And
wow. I mean, so yeah, someone needs to make you some placebo patches and see if you can tell the difference.
I love to do that.
Well, no, there's a great N-in-1 experiment, because, yeah, I'm skeptical. But look, if you actually, you know, if you could get someone to make you some batches and you could tell them which is which, that would be juicy.
That's a good idea. I'm actually going to reach out to them, see if they'll do that for me. That'd be amazing.
Well, but then they'd just be proving them. Well, if they're really confident in their product, they should give it to you. And if they're not, they're going to refuse.
I'm literally going to email them after this, be like...
Oh my God, they should write. I mean, they should be like, oh my God, our stuff is so awesome. Of course you're going to be able to see the difference, right?
Yeah, I'm not kidding. I'm going to reach out to them and see what they say. Well, this has been so fabulous. You're incredible. I cannot thank you enough for all the work that you're doing. I asked you this last time. Are you writing a new book now?
I absolutely am. So How Not to Hurt is my next major book on lifestyle approaches to pain management. And I just wrote a book on Ozempic, which will be out by the end of the month. About an audiobook, softcover, and ebook by the end of the month. I'm doing a 3-hour webinar on the subject next month. A lot of interesting nuance about these GLP-1 agonists.
Yeah. What's the book called? The Ozempic book?
It is called Ozempic. I forget the subtitle. So it's called Ozempic. It's like pros, cons, and natural alternatives, something like that.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Greger. I appreciate you so much. The last question that I ask every single guest on this show, and it's because I'm so passionate about mindset. So what is something that you're grateful for?
Oh my God. I am grateful to do work that I love, that I feel that I'm good at, and that actually makes a difference in the world. Like, that's the Venn diagram, right? I mean, you can imagine someone who's like an amazing pianist and they love playing piano, but it's like, okay, what are you actually doing for the world? I mean, that's cool. That's 2 out of 3. That's awesome, right? It's better than being a really good piano player that hates playing piano, right? But if you could find something in life where you're good, you feel like you're better than most at it, and it actually brings you joy, and as the benefit actually reduces suffering in the world, oh my God, that's what you have to dedicate your life to. And I'm just so lucky that I just ended up being able to do that all day, every day. And so I couldn't be more thankful.
Awesome. I love it so much. You are the best. Thank you so much. Hopefully you can come back again in the future for that pain book. That'd be really amazing.
Oh, that'll be fun. Yeah. I'm really looking forward to writing it and seeing what's out there to help people.
Yay. Well, have a good rest of your day. I appreciate everything you're doing so much. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Keep up the good work.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for listening to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast. For more information, you can check out my book, What When Wine, Lose Weight and Feel Great with Paleo Style Meals, Intermittent Fasting, and Wine, as well as my blog, MelanieAvalon.com. Feel free to contact me at podcast@MelanieAvalon.com. And always remember, you got this.